Now entering Nerdist.com.
Big Pop Fun.
It's big love, pop art, and fun times from the Wilson World Studios in California, USA. It's Big Pop Fun. Here's Tom Wilson.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Big Pop Fun, the podcast with Tom Wilson, your host. No adjectives. I'm just hosting it this time. I will not try to describe any further the nature of my hosting, because that will invite self-derision. And who needs that, really? Welcome to another magical sleigh ride of enchantment and wonder as we welcome the sun. As we welcome back the warmth of brother sun to awaken every seed, every bulb, every slumbering bulb under the earth, every slumbering beast of the forest ending their hibernation. But as an often slumbering beast myself, hey, I have a suggestion. Maybe we'd better just leave them alone and do our own sun welcoming without them. Until they feel like joining us, because if there's anything we know about slumbering beasts like myself, just leave them alone, because they wake up slow. Thanks to Jeff Harlan, my announcer, who's always been there for me. Jeff has an episode of the podcast. If you haven't listened to it, please listen to it. Jeff Harlan, H-A-R-L-A-N. Jeff's been all over the city, performing, singing songwriter gigs lately, telling me about them and having fun. So look out for Jeff. It's always brought to you by my book, The Masked Man, available on Nook or Kindle or iPad. Please, if you haven't read the book, give it a read. I'll bet you enjoy it. It's an interesting and unusual book, and also brought to you by art. Art all the time, brought to you by art. Support artists. You'll be out there this summer as the sun warms us all and invites us all out to the parks and to the rolling hills. There are going to be art shows. There are going to be people sketching on streets. There are going to be bands with an open guitar case hoping that you'll slip in some loose change or a buck. Hey, do it, would you? Help out artists everywhere. I am an artist, and I have been on the street years and years ago. Well, I'll tell that another time, but I was out and I street performed with the open case and the whole thing. That is one tough gig. So help those people out. I started my art. Well, I was, my friend Greg, when I was in elementary school, he was a great artist. He could really draw with those big fat pencils that we had. Maybe they were normally sized pencils and we were just small. They just felt like really fat pencils. And he would take the fat pencils and draw all kinds of things. Draw fanciful cartoon things, draw army men. He drew a lot of army men. You know, that's what you drew back then. Vietnam was still going on, and so guys with helmets and shooting and all that kind of stuff didn't really mess us up that much. But I tried to draw. I didn't feel like I was very good at it. I drew construction workers. Greg drew army guys and people, getting stabbed and stuff. I drew, I don't know why, I drew bulldozers and guys working at the sides of my loose leaf paper. You know where the holes are on the loose leaf with the lines? Well, the side near the holes would be guys digging the hole or people driving bulldozers with piles of dirt. It seemed easier to me because the bulldozers were sort of a square with like a shovel thing that was kind of a parentheses thing. It was kind of easy to draw. And then I drew sort of stick figures, but then I thicken them up with clothes. So you draw the stick figure, and then you just make it fat, and that looks like a shirt. So that's the kind of drawing I did. But then hippies were out, so I did peace. I was really good at peace signs because I saw this poster, one of those Day Glow posters in one of those, one of those stores with black lights and beads hanging from the ceiling. And I saw this peace sign, and it was a block peace sign with sort of you know, had the peace sign shape. I don't know. It was kind of artistically done. So I went home, took out a piece of loose leaf, and I just took a plate to make a circle. Boom, make a circle. I figured that's okay. That's the outside of the peace sign. I found a smaller plate, put it inside. Now we got the circle. Now I got strip. Get out a ruler. Boom, boom, peace sign. But then I took the edges and I made them a little fancy and a little curved. And then I colored it and then I put it on one of my books or something. And people said, wow, that's really cool. Wow. So I thought, wow, I'm an artist. I made a peace sign with plates and a ruler and a little bit of pizzazz. Then Earth Day was coming, and then there was a big, in the Philadelphia Inquirer, there was a big section on Earth Day, how we have to save the Earth. At the time, of course, everyone was driving V8 cars, guzzling leaded gasoline, but Earth Day was big. So Earth Day had a symbol, a logo of the Earth, like, I don't know, waves and a mountain and clean air or something. And that was the logo of Earth Day. So I took that from the paper and I made an Earth Day logo. And then I put that on my stuff. And people, wow, it's cool. An Earth Day logo. Hey, make one for me. Now, everyone been making fun of me. It felt like everyone hated me because I was sick from school all the time and I would just come back to get pushed around. So I didn't really feel like doing it for anyone. But then they said, well, I'll give you a dime. I think it was a dime. I don't think that. Well, they offered to pay me, like two people, maybe three. They offered to pay me to make one. So I made two or three of them. I gave them away and the people never paid me. So that's, you know, got ripped up. My first commissioned art project got ripped off. What are you going to do? There's 30 cents owed to me somewhere in Eastern Pennsylvania because I know the people saved the Earth Day thing that I made. I think the third one was pretty bad because I was kind of sick of doing it. I made one that was one extra one that was really good. And then the next one was like, okay, let's get this over with. The third one, you know, slap bang, let's get it out. But they still owe me a dime because they ordered it. David Darrow is an old friend of mine. David is an artist who went to the Art Center College of Design. He's been an illustrator. And we talk about the difference between illustrator and painter, I believe, in our conversation. And I think you'll enjoy my conversation with an artist, a very talented artist, illustrator, painter. He's you could check him out on DarrowArt.com or DaveThePaintingGuy.com. I hope you enjoy my conversation with Dave the Painting Guy, David Darrow.
It's Big Pop Fun with Tom Wilson.
David Darrow is on Big Pop Fun. You're a listener.
I am.
You're a listener. I'm so glad.
From the very beginning.
I'm very glad that you are and that you enjoy it. And I'm glad that you're on now.
Yeah, that's great.
Do painters talk shop a lot about painting?
Yes and no. There are painters and illustrators out there that they think that they have big secrets they don't want to tell anyone, so
They think they have big secrets?
They think they do, yeah. You know, most the people that have been in the business a while can kind of figure out how they did what they did, but there's a group of painters or illustrators that don't want to divulge how they accomplished the painting, and then there's others that are just very happy to share, and they're teachers or they give workshops.
So it's like Eddie Van Halen that would cover his left hand during guitar solos, so all the kids wouldn't be able to see what he's doing.
I didn't know someone was copying me. I
try to copy you the best I can.
I cover my brush. Have you seen?
During your show, yeah.
Yeah.
So you are a native Los Angelino.
Yes.
Are you not?
For the most part, yeah. We moved a few times when I was a kid.
When you were little?
I was a big kid, so no.
I was never not little. In utero?
In utero.
Yeah.
Yeah. Moved a lot in utero. I grew up in Playa del Rey. Uh-huh. And I say I grew up there because I landed there when I was 10 and lasted through high school there, and then I went off to art school. So that's really my growing up here.
And you were a Westchester Comet.
Yes, I was.
Yes, you were, along with my wife, Caroline.
You know the mascot of our school.
I know the Westchester Comets like the back of my wife's hand because she actually went there. I have no idea anything about the school.
Approximate year did she go there?
She graduated in 06. 1906. I don't know when she graduated. 1970, 78, 79, something like that.
Okay. So she was there right around the same time.
I suppose.
I was out of there by 75.
But you were an arts guy? Did you do? Were you just a regular goofball, or were you doing all the? Because you know, I guess my question is easy.
You're hitting on all three.
Yeah.
I think.
Did you have the gift very early on? Were you the kid, and when you were 7 years old, just drawing better than everyone else?
Kind of. Yeah. It was. I had some aptitude, if that's what you're asking.
Yeah. When does that occur to you when you're a kid?
Occur to me that I'm better than everyone else.
My picture looks way better than Mikey's.
It's kind of better when Mikey comes and says, Yours is better than mine. Wow, look at that. That's cool.
And you sort of noticed that
I had
it
a little
is.
Period there where I was drawing heads cut off and knives in backs because that got a lot of attention. But then my mom said, David, we don't want you drawing that kind of stuff.
But you were a boy.
We don't want you to use your talents in that way.
What did you move on from knives going into heads?
Devils. No, I didn't. I'm teasing.
Really?
No, what? I realized it was unpleasing to my parents, and so I didn't draw that stuff anymore. Did you keep drawing
from that point? Did it become sort of obsessive?
I don't want to pretend I'm one of these guys who just had a notebook and drawing all the time. Uh-huh. I really did almost all of my drawing in church, sitting next to my mom and dad, because we'd have Sunday school, and you couldn't draw there. You had to make crafts and hear stories. And then at our church, we'd go from Sunday school to sit with the adults in what we called big church. And so I'd sit there, and the pew in front of you would have the offering envelopes next to the hymnals.
Sure.
And so I would take out an offering envelope, and I'd draw on the back of that during the whole time. I could do two or three envelopes in a service.
What kind of stuff were you drawing then? I would draw the pastor. Oh, you would draw live drawing?
For people in the choir, yeah. And my mom, sometimes my mom would chuckle because she'd know exactly who I drew at a pretty early age.
My daughter did that. My daughter's studying art now. She's quite an artist.
Break her fingers and a brush.
Yeah, but she would draw, like very early on, we noticed that it was in proportion, in perspective. It was interesting the way that she saw was different than other people. Because I think it is the way that you see,
exactly.
Not the way that your finger works the pencil.
Very good, yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, you're an artist, so you know that. But I've had people ask me if they could look at my hands.
Oh, because there's something magic with them or something?
Yeah, they want to see if it's an artist's hand or something. No, they're just chubby hot dogs with hair growing off them.
Yeah.
And it's really, I just tell them, no, it's really the way I see and the way I perceive stuff. And then the hand is, you know, something you can build some skill with and how to hold a brush or a pencil, but really... That comes down to what can I use to make what I see come about on paper.
And were you just were you doing the same thing in high school? Or did you start working at it, or were you just kind of, you know, the high school of California? I mean, I can only imagine what high school in the 70s in California was like, because I was in Pennsylvania, but you kids with the beach and Disneyland and everything.
Yeah, we didn't really study, as you probably well know.
It's pretty idyllic.
They had a sport class. What do you call it? It's not a sports class, but instead of PE, you could sign up for surf class.
You really could?
Yeah, and they would have to meet at 5:30 in the morning before school every day, show up, and roll call was there, and these guys would surf. I didn't do it because I didn't want to get up early.
I did squash club that way, and then I quit very soon. I liked squash. I liked playing squash, kind of pre-racquetball. It's a great sport, but they had a club, and that's back, you know, when one of the two times where I really went for it in life. You know, let's do it. Sure, it's squash. I could do that. I'll get up early, and I'll get good at squash.
It would be good for me to get up early.
Exactly. So, and then the first time, like, oh my god, playing squash at 5:30. Exactly.
It's going to be cold. You know,
so the second club meeting of squash, I was like, I don't. It's just hitting a ball around. It doesn't really matter.
You suddenly rationalize how stupid squash.
Yeah, squash is the dumbest thing I've ever seen. No, squash is still a good sport. Just not when it's dark.
Yeah. Surfing is kind of the same.
Yeah, well, that's true.
Cold.
Were you making all the banners at school and doing that stuff?
I tried not to get used a lot.
Yeah,
because
always smart.
It come down to work, you know.
Yep.
It's like, hey, you're good. Do the banner, and then it's, you know, lettering is hard. And you have to draw it all out first, and I'm very impatient.
So, what artistically were you doing at that time?
In high school, junior high?
That kind of stuff.
I kind of went from being the kid that could draw better than everyone else in class, and then there were a few competitors. There were some guys in class that could did better cartoons than I did, and I was trying to draw more realistically or learn cool things from Mad Magazine, or back in my day, it was Peter Max, was like,
well,
doing,
sure, yeah,
doing really cool stuff with
Phantasmagoria, that yeah. Stuff with all the very, very. I mean, he
well,
did
Peter
not
Max
do.
Was a very color. He did all the 7-Up ads back then. Remember that?
I remember
the,
very well.
Okay,
I mean, Peter Max. I'm a big fan of Peter Max for that period.
Well, you lost me on the Phantasmagoria. What did you say?
I had a book. I had a Peter Max book cover. Which had his logo on it, because as we all know, how dedicated to freedom and the passion of the late 60s, all the artists were, as soon as they could, they copyright it,
right.
Put their name on it, make sure they're getting paid, but that's fine. I have nothing wrong with that. But on the back of the cover of the book, it said, just in big psychedelic letters, Phantasmagoria.
Oh, I didn't even know about that.
Yeah.
You still have it?
Oddly enough, my book covers from the sixth grade have long since been lost.
I saved everything.
But did you really?
No.
Peter Max was, a very important artist of that time.
Yeah. He kind of established the art from the hippie era.
Well, he did. He wasn't the originator, I think, of that colorful stuff. Because who did Yellow Submarine in that look? That was actually...
I thought Yellow Submarine was... Peter Max, and I could
it
be
was
wrong.
Credited to someone else, I no. believe. But anyway, at that specific time, it was very lots of love and peace lettering,
right.
With lots of dreamy. It was figurative. I mean, it was people or a woman floating on clouds, those kind of stuff.
Very peaceful stuff. Yeah.
Very peaceful stuff.
And then there was Rick Griffin. Do you remember that name?
I do not.
He was kind of surfer art, but he did a lot of psychedelic. Posters from the late 60s and surf art. He got picked up by Surf Magazine or Surfer Magazine. I don't remember which one, but that's where I became aware of his stuff. And he did really cool. He, in addition to painting really cool things, he painted the poster for, I was going to say five Easy Pieces, but that wasn't it. It was a summer surf movie. It's got a five in it. I can't remember the name.
I don't know.
Anyway, it's a picture of a kid reaching out with a bar of surf wax in his hand. That's coming out in the foreground. It's very 3D mm-hmm. looking. And so he did a lot of poster art and album covers. I think he might have done some Grateful Dead.
So your stuff early on, you were really impressed with very 2D, very acrylic-like.
Not even color.
Bright color. No, not
all
color.
All I could handle at that time was pen and ink when I was in elementary school and junior high.
Uh-huh.
The color was scary. Didn't know anything about color except, straight out of the tube or right out of the jar.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. Not mixing anything.
Yeah, and then junior high, I had an interesting childhood where I was very insecure. I guess like everyone else in junior high, and I just didn't fit in anywhere. And the art stuff I did, the cartoons of the teachers, mocking the teachers, and the cartoons and things I did that got me into the yearbook class by ninth grade. Those got me positive attention, so
mm-hmm.
that's kind of where it was born.
So you were just a kind of a loner like kid. Did the art
not
make
intentionally,
you,
but yeah, it worked out that way.
It worked out that way because you were doing art and no one else did it, so they just left you alone, or
no.
Because you had just that unusual bent that you just didn't have a lot of friends and you ended up drawing because of it.
It was a combination of the two, but mostly I think this is the way I would size it up. I just felt at an early age I was a very odd kid.
You felt at an early age. You
yeah.
could feel it within yourself that you were odd.
Yeah, and not like better than everyone else. It was like everyone else was better than me, but not in a real depressed way. Like I would try and – I was an attention seeker. Mm-hmm. I would do headstands and spin on my head, and I would build tall things and knock them down. A lot of ADD stuff that would just come to my mind to do right now. And I thought I was entertaining, and then people weren't laughing. And so I would conclude that I'm a doofus, and I'd calm down for another 5 minutes and then try something else and – the drawing seemed to work.
So the drawings
got good attention, and I kind of grew it because of that.
Uh-huh.
Well, this is nice. People say nice things about my...
So by the time you got out of high school, but you went right to art school.
I did. No, I didn't go right to art school. I goofed around for a year and hung around with the wrong kids. And
oh, you did?
And my parents had a little talk with me. My dad had a talk with me about getting serious about what I'm going to do with the rest of my life.
Going to the beach and just...
Yeah, it was like
living out a
Dayglow
surf poster kind of existence.
Yeah, I wasn't allowed to have long hair, so I didn't look like a surfer. I didn't really want to hang out with the surfers because they had a whole culture that I just wasn't interested in.
Yeah,
But I surfed a lot, tanned a lot. I worked on my tan.
Isn't surfing? I mean, I've really I can't say that I've ever been up on a surfboard because I'm very big. My legs are all rickety. So every time I've, you know, with a very high center of gravity, surfing has always been difficult for me. So I say I do not surf, but I have had a board out in the ocean and splashed around and fell off it a number of times, millions of times. But my point being, I haven't even done what you could call surfing. And yet I still find it kind of magical. And when I'm out there, you really see how it can be just almost hypnotizing to a person and just kind of, I just want to do this.
It is. There's some moments in catching a wave that are exciting and wonderful, but there's also it's just a peaceful time when you're waiting for the waves.
Mm-hmm.
Just sitting out there past everything, waiting for a bigger set to come in.
Yeah, and just kind of going up and down a little bit.
It's really just you.
Mm-hmm.
And guys, you know, we go and do something together. We don't really talk to each other. We just sit side by side and stare at the horizon waiting for a wave, and that's a great day with another friend.
Yeah. My daughter surfs a lot, and I'm really jealous of her. I mean, she's always out there.
But you're wrong about your size. That's not the issue. The issue is the size of the board. If you had, I'm not joking, if you had a 10, 11, 12-foot board, maybe 4 inches thick at the center, the biggest board I ever rode was 11 and a half feet, and it was 5.5 inches. And the guy that let me borrow it weighed 350 pounds.
Wow.
He would get out there and catch these 2-foot waves at Malibu.
Wow.
This was in my adult life.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I just said one day, can I try that? He said, sure. And the only difference was it was like a boat to get moving.
Right, right.
And then then you could catch anything because mm-hmm. you could just start, if you saw a wave a quarter mile away coming in, you just start paddling now, and by the time you got that thing moving,
you're about
the wave
4 feet.
Grabs you.
Right,
and
right.
then you stand up, and it was like being on a sidewalk. Uh-huh. It didn't teeter or anything. It was just rock steady.
Uh-huh.
And then turning was the other issue.
Sure, it just goes straight.
Take a few steps backward and see if you can put enough mm-hmm. weight on it to curve it
I
over.
Think at that point, specifically at that point, the 11.5, 12-foot surfboard that's 5.5 inches thick, one should consider buying a boat.
That's really? That is kind of a crossover point.
I think you're at a crossover point where you should maybe say, possibly I'm a boater.
Yeah.
Maybe I should get myself a different hat. but as I say, growing up in Pennsylvania and living in California as I do and going out on the ocean, you know, and the sun is setting, and I was once at El Puerto, one of the surf beaches, uh-huh. and I'm there and I'm just trying to stay out of the way of the young guys who can really surf and everything.
But
dolphins started coming around. And it was amazing because all of the surfers just quieted down. Nobody catches waves anymore. And they brought their surfboards sort of into a circle together and just everyone remained quiet. And the dolphins just swam around everyone.
That's awesome.
And it was just, it was like something out of Life of Pi. You just thought, this is absolute magic. It was unbelievable. And then
were you out there in the water with them?
I was in the water with them.
Oh,
yes.
Nice.
Yeah.
So you were one of the circlers.
I was one of the circlers.
Nice.
And the kid and the young surf dudes actually. Once the dolphins come around, I think then we begin the communal aspect
right.
of surfing.
Then you're part
where
of
where everyone is welcome to the dolphin swimming circle. And before that, they would like to stab
Kill
me
you.
In the head
yeah.
like one
right.
of your drawings. The big dude who just keeps getting in everyone's way.
Yeah, but I would imagine someone of your size and stature. Would either make them want to stay away from you or they would just back off and let you catch whatever wave you want.
I don't sweat surf rats, if that's
okay.
the issue you're
that's
bringing up.
That's kind of what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
I noticed as I got older, once I hit 40, then it was they just kind of backed off and let the old guy have the wave, which was really cool.
Right, that's fine.
I didn't get hassled by anybody.
Yeah.
At 40.
Yeah, at 40, yeah.
40. I'm the old guy.
but yeah, when you're younger than that, yes, they all have that, especially living in the valley as I do. Vals stay out, and only these kinds of people can surf at this beach, and young guys get into fist fights, and there's all kinds of surf stuff that that fortunately I'm not a part of.
Yeah, that's the part of the culture that I didn't want to fit into.
Yeah, exactly.
I got run over a few times on purpose by people who...
Yeah.
I didn't know the rules, and they did, and so they enforced them.
Yeah.
There I was with a broken board.
Yeah, that's not good.
But what does this have to do with art? I forgot.
Well, that you were...
That's what I was doing in high school. That's what.
You took a year off in order to go out with surf dudes, and then Dad said, hey, Dave, come on. You got to pull it together a little bit.
They didn't ask me for rent.
they didn't?
No. I'm just recalling Steve Odekirk talking about it.
Oh, yeah. Dad talked to him about rent.
Yeah. You already charged me.
Yeah, last month. What? Is this every month?
Yeah. It's a great interview.
But when Dad told you to pull it together and you went to your skill set, which was art, and decided to go. Now, what school did you attend?
I don't recall. This was 150 years ago when I was in high school. But I did something that looked like gainful employment, and I tried to start my own business, and it was really something simple, just painting the numbers on curbs.
You were literally painting the numbers on curbs.
Yeah, I made my own stencil set and got spray cans and a bucket of white paint, and then made up flyers about me and my friend Mark Simon. We were going to use this to make money so we could go to the schools we wanted to go to, and we made up flyers that said help a couple kids go to college, and I drew a cartoon of a guy painting a curb, and we put them on people's doors and asked them if they would just, you know, donate, I think it was $2 or something like that. And we just hit the wealthy areas, Baldwin Hills, and that's as far as I could drive. So
yeah, Baldwin Hills, not that wealthy.
At the time.
At the time, okay, it's 70s.
It was. Baldwin Hills may have changed, I don't know. I haven't been around since the 70s. But.
So, and then you went to school from there.
Then,
it ended up working.
Thank you. My dad took me aside at the end of the year in 1976, and he said, I appreciate seeing you put some effort in, good hard work. And he said, I think you should go ahead and apply to Art Center, which is where I wanted to go. A fairly expensive art school, but with a good name. You just go ahead and go. I'll pay for the first semester, and we'll see where it goes from there. Maybe you can pay for the next one or whatever. So the agreement was I would pay for half my school. And in the end, I did really well in the school. He paid for everything. He just said, yeah, keep going. And so I got through it in 3.5 years.
When you go to art school, specifically art school, do you go there with an agenda? I'm going, like in college, I would like to be an architect. Do you go to art school saying, I would like to be a fine art painter of oil. I would like to be a graphic designer and make rock posters. Or I would like to work in some aspect of the arts. Or are you just taking a bunch of classes? It's in just about everything, and you kind of find your way.
It's a little bit different than both of those options you gave me. And if you're
I'm sorry, those are the options, Dave.
Oh, then I would pick number two.
Okay.
Yeah, because they do give you a variety of classes that – you know, like regular college, I don't want to take that. Well, you have to take it.
Right.
I actually talk about this on my own podcast because I was introducing why I became an artist and why I went to school. And one of the interesting things was I was told all the way through high school, you should be an artist.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if there's dumber advice on the face of the earth.
Right. Like, what does that mean?
Having a high school teacher tell you, you're so good at this, you should be an artist for a living, you know. And so I thought that sounded pretty good. I went to after high school, I went and worked at a Christian summer camp, and while I was there, I met someone whose sister or cousin had gone to Art Center, and they heard that I wanted to go there. And said, oh yeah, my sister or cousin, whatever it was, went there, and she just graduated recently, and she's already doing all the fashion drawings for Robinson's. It wasn't Robinson's.
Robinson's, a department store in
LA.
Yeah,
it wasn't Robinson's May back then. It was just Robinson's. And they said, you know, they print them up full size in the LA Times every Sunday. And she's making $400 a week. And I just, my jaw dropped.
Mm.
That's a lot of money to me.
Right.
Back then. Well, still is.
Yeah,
actually.
Yeah.
But that settled it for me. Okay, I'm going to go to school and become an artist. Did not know how an artist makes money, but she was making money. That was kind of, in my shallow 17-year-old mind, that was good enough. 18. So I went to school, I applied, and the school said, we're going to put you in our illustration program. So I didn't even ask if I could go into the illustration program or fine art or whatever. I presented a portfolio with my application, and the portfolio was basically everything I'd drawn in high school and a couple of yearbooks that I did cartoons in and some stuff I did on my own. And they said, you're, you know... you're good enough. We'll take your money.
Sure, sure.
And we'll put you in our illustration program. So that's when I became an illustrator, I guess, studying for illustration. I didn't decide to do that. They decided that, and I said, okay.
Can you briefly, just so everyone understands what illustration means, other than being a fine art painter or graphic designer, so when they say be an illustrator, what do they mean?
I actually had to kind of look it up myself when I got the acceptance letter that said we're going to put you in our illustration program. I wanted to, I didn't even know. The only illustrator I'd ever heard of was Norman Rockwell, and really it's just it's a term that goes back to illumination and illustration. They're both related, and it's bringing light to something. And an illustrator creates visuals that help, that are kind of supportive of a story. Probably the most common thing would be Ladies' Home Journal and all the magazines from the 50s and 60s, maybe the 20s through the 60s, that had compelling miniature novels, short stories. And then they would have a big illustration on one whole page.
Yeah.
And that would be a supportive thing to the story. So it was a decoration. I just call it decoration for stories.
Yeah, a painting, certainly, but a painting that's the characters in the story whatever, in the magazine.
Gives them a face. Yes. And it's really, the artist comes up with that. The artist hires the models or hires his friends, usually, and then turns them into, you know, old man Peabody or whatever. That he gets a vision of what that guy looks like, either from the story or just in his own mind. Hires a friend or a professional model, lights it the right way, takes photographs, and then gets busy painting it and sends it in.
Which is also book covers, movie posters, all sorts of things.
Back in the day, album covers. A lot of things that used to use art that don't anymore. I mean, used to use hand-done art, painted or drawn. And that kind of thing all had its own flavor and feel for that time period. You can look at old illustrations and kind of tell when that era was, just because that's what was popular. Everybody was doing it.
So you'd be painting mostly on board, not canvas, right?
Yeah, illustration board.
Like gouache or acrylic, or what would you be painting in? What medium?
I don't recall that being part of the school assignments.
So you just do whatever you wanted to?
No, it wasn't. It was rigid with some freedom, if that makes any sense. Most of the classes that were about illustration, they would give you an assignment that had to be a solution to this particular problem, and it might be satisfying thirst. That might be the theme. And so you have to come up with a cold drink or something like that with, you know, ice and condensation and drips off the glass and you know, sell the piece. That was if it was advertising illustration. If it was a short story, then that would be editorial illustration. And that would be something where you had a lot more freedom. You know, you see more big fat brush strokes and maybe splatters and things like that that create action and activity. They're not trying to sell anything. You're just, it's the artist's interpretation of setting a mood for the story. But the early classes were really just about drawing. We did life drawing, and we did design concepts, how to compose and how to balance out the field of a rectangle that you have to fill in with paint.
And life drawing for people would be just with a model.
Yes.
You know, a model who either costumed, nude, drawing, whatever, of the human person.
Right. So they had those classes. You had to take life drawing. I think you had to take life drawing for the first half of your schooling, and then the I would say I had to take it every semester. It was part of the curriculum all the time. Just keep drawing.
Because as they say, which is very true, certainly in my experience, life drawing is the foundation of everything. And if you can draw a person that looks even close to what a person looks like, that takes a lot of attention. Because proportions, and it's the easiest thing in the world is to wreck a drawing of a person.
Yes,
and to make it look wrong.
And if it's a pretty person and you don't do them well, they're not pretty. It's really easy to draw monsters. For example, you just take a human face and distort it and put longer, taller things on it.
The eyes can be further apart. Right. The nose can be misshapen.
You can distort what God came up with and make it a monster, but trying to draw something exactly as it looks, trying to draw a beautiful woman, Those are very difficult things. If I draw a tree and I draw it out of proportion, you still get that it's a tree and it's not that interesting to look at, but you do that with a human and suddenly they know you can't draw.
Exactly. Because, I mean, if the eye is off by the 16th of an inch, well, that's true. That's just there's something wrong with the drawing. So either sell it as some cubist thing or something experimental, but it's not working as a person because we all know that that's not what a person looks like.
Right. And if you could, you know, and not everyone that went to art school knew how to draw people well. Everyone had their own discipline. One of the first weeks I was there, it was in orientation week, and there was a gal there that did the most wonderful caricatures of different races. She drew Asians and black people and white people and Irish, and she had, you know, the costumes and everything. And I was just blown away by the quality of the character that she invented. And by the end of schooling, she put in the whole 8 semesters for a lot of money. And she was drawing exactly the same by the end because she came in doing it really well. And she just, you know, I'm not saying she didn't learn anything, but she didn't change that. That was
her approach remained the same.
Yeah.
Did your approach change?
Yeah, because I wasn't very good when I got in. I was good enough to get into the school, but by the end, and I think it was related to good teaching from some of the teachers and then the competitive nature of the school and my desire to be better than everyone else because I used to be. I wanted to get to the end of school and be better than everyone else, which I did not achieve, but that goal of wanting to always get wow from people in every time I turned in an assignment. We don't just turn in an assignment. You put it on a critique board. And
sure.
Everyone gets to see it. So all the people in your class that you're competing with, which is the way I viewed it, they get to see your work. And so I had to put extra in. And she, you know, and people treated it differently. I have a good friend, Steve Gray, was a cartoonist. And is a cartoonist. Whimsical art. There's all kinds of different names for it. But he's made a very good living drawing pretty much the same kind of characters in the pen and ink work that he was doing when he was in school. And here it is, you know, 35 years later, he's doing the same thing, and he's still very busy.
And what is he? Are those pieces that you frame and put up in your house?
No.
Like,
no,
what
are
kind
used
of...
For,
used for advertising and things like that?
Advertising, yeah, and stories. And, I mean, I don't know. I haven't researched his work. Well, I've seen what he does, but he just shows the illustrations. You don't necessarily know what they were used for.
Well, when you got out of school, what did you go right to advertising and making bottles of Schlitz that are in ice and things? What?
I took an easy way out. They did. They had interview day. You know, eighth semester, ready to graduate. 3 weeks before, they've got corporations coming in and seeing who they want to snake. And I took my portfolio to a meeting with some people from General Dynamics. Convair Division in San Diego, they made cruise missiles, and they were a defense contractor, and it was San Diego, and I thought, I could move to San Diego if these people would hire me, and they liked my work. I guess I was one of the only illustrators that actually
interviewed them.
Yeah, I don't know who else they were looking for, but what they told me was that they could really use my illustration skills to illustrate the artist's conception of a cruise missile. 4 feet over off the water.
Sure, and you have a landscape, and it's a desert,
yeah.
And you see the missile.
And I had nothing in my portfolio that looked like that,
mm-hmm.
But they saw that I had some painting skill, and I thought this would be a great opportunity to learn how to do that stuff because they're going to pay me, and I can learn on the job. And so I took the job, and they moved me down to San Diego, and I got my first job at 22, and I was working in an art department, and then, you know,
for in the defense industry. Art department of the defense industry.
Yeah, it makes sense to you, doesn't it?
Yeah,
an art department. There was an illustrator there named Roy Jertson, who was about, I'm guessing he was 65, and I was 22, and apparently I had an air of being a hotshot walking in, strutting until I met him, and this guy was the guy that was doing all the paintings,
mm-hmm.
And I never. In the whole time I was there, which was only 9 months, and then a big company layoff, and they cut everyone they just hired. But he had the job. That was the job. I wanted to do that stuff. But the way it works in that industry is in the company, every department has a budget. And if they need something from another department, they have to spend from their budget to buy it from them. So we needed photographs and paste-ups and stuff like that for slideshows that they would do for presenting. And we had to buy from the photo department so we could make transparencies and slides in our department. And so when people came to the art department to get a painting of a cruise missile or an airplane, they went to Roy because Roy was the guy that's been doing it for years.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't going to hire a 22-year-old
kid. So you were only there for 9 months. You didn't get a chance to paint a rivet.
No, but I did get to do cartoons for the retirement guys, the guys that were retiring whenever they would have a party.
The gold watch and a drawing from Dave.
No, not even that good. I mean, they could have the drawing, but I was just doing the art for a flyer.
Oh,
saying,
okay.
Saying, come to Joe's party.
How did you get into, like, portraiture and stuff from working? I mean, now, in illustration, you did book covers, yes?
I did.
Did you do that kind of the Harlequin romance, the woman in a man's arms, whatever, that kind of stuff?
Yeah, I didn't get the good ones with, you know, Fabio and the real hot gals.
No, you just got
the heaving chest and all.
Yeah.
No, I got kind of docile stories about the young single mom who meets a nice cowboy at the diner that she works at.
Oh, okay. And
so not very saucy, love involved still.
When
so
you paint a lot of those illustrations, like, where did they go? Does the book company kind of own that? It's stored next to the Lost Ark somewhere in a warehouse?
In many cases, yes. It kind of depends on how you run your contract and how diligent you are at having them send it back. But eventually in the 80s, it got to where we could just send a 4x5 transparency of the original art, and they were just going to scan that.
So do you have at your house, or are there just stacks of diner paintings with a woman?
Several big boxes.
Really?
Of art, yeah.
Of all those?
I just shot a whole bunch of them. A few weeks ago, because I'm actually thinking of tossing them out. Because
Toss them out.
I've been carrying. They're nothing you'd ever want to hang on your wall.
Why? I want the one with the diner, with the woman and the guy, the cowboy. She meets a cowboy in a diner.
I could introduce you to her.
That's a great story.
One of my Facebook friends is the model of the.
Oh, really?
Of the woman.
Really?
Yeah.
Is she?
Yeah. I mean, she's Facebook friends now. We connected after 30 years.
I mean, I know that. I know that so many artists, so many illustrators have so many people from their lives who pose for them.
Yeah.
Even, I mean, Norman Rockwell used the whole, what is it?
The whole town.
The whole town of Massachusetts.
Yeah.
Stockbridge, Massachusetts, yeah. Where everyone, now all the old lady, I mean, everyone had posed for Norman Rockwell.
Well, he was much busier than I ever was.
Well, yes, but
I
did
got
you.
Halfway down the block, and as
once you start doing illustrations, are you ending up calling, hey, Lisa, could you come on? I need like a woman to be a waitress in a diner. Could I put an outfit on you and have you pose in my studio?
Yeah, I didn't get to do that many illustrations of people. I was kind of a jack of all trades type of an illustrator. Mostly just trying to feed my family.
Yeah.
And, you know, make a living and put a roof over our heads.
You've done art for a living, you know, for your whole adult life. Was there, along the way, have there been...
You're going to get real personal, aren't you?
No, I'm not. I don't think so. Have there been pieces that have really kind of taken your breath away that you're really so happy with that you have up in your house now, or that you gave to someone, or something that strikes you, or because it's the way you make a living and you went to school for it and it is, you know, it's, hey, this is how I put food on the table. You're just going, look, sweaty beer bottle and a bunch of ice, lady in a diner. Portrait of a person. Do you know what I mean? Is it a trade
there,
for you?
There were never any that took my breath away or that I was just proud of them because it was represented a really good work that I did.
Yeah.
Everything I've ever done, if I have it hanging around, it just bothers me because I know what needs to be fixed. I can see I wish I just had a little more time to do that, or I wish I hadn't procrastinated so long because then I would have had a little more time. I always see everything on every piece I do. I wish I had a little more time to go back into it. But I learned early on, it's got to let it go.
So every piece in your house,
every piece in my house is, I don't have any illustration work hanging in my house.
What's hanging in your house? The house of an artist who has been an artist your whole life?
Several oil paintings of mine, a painting of my daughter, and a couple pieces that didn't sell at a gallery showing that I really like. So I just hung them up and waiting for another opportunity to do a gallery show someday.
What kind of paintings are they?
People, just random strangers. In 2000, Actually, 1999, Christmas of 1999, it was for my first marriage, which had disappeared. It was not my...
It vanished. It had existed, and then vanished, it disappeared.
I actually came
back to the house, and it ended up, it's a vacant lot. Yeah. I don't know.
It wasn't just the family was gone. Yeah. The marriage was gone.
I have a far more deep and impressive imagination than I had thought, because it was gone.
It was and then I questioned if I ever even had a marriage or if that was just an illusion. Yeah. I still don't know to this day, but I did get married a second time, but we don't need to talk about that. Because that
went well, and in its own way.
Did I say vanished or did I say disappeared?
You said, I think
I was trying to avoid the D word. I got divorced.
Yeah. No problem. No, I understand. Okay. It's all right. Things happen in life.
And it was all her fault. And I just like to say that.
She was never good for you.
She was never.
She was never. Nobody ever liked. Come on. Nobody ever liked her. Come on. We've been waiting,
she's a wonderful woman, to come to your senses. I'm delighted that she's the mother of my children, because she's a great mom.
Yes, yes.
But this was shortly after the divorce, and this happened to be a Christmas that I didn't have the kids. And which is an interesting concept when you're divorced. You'd spend Christmases alone, or you find something else to do, and there's not a lot to do on Christmas alone. And I decided to paint. I hadn't painted in a couple of years. It was I had some dark years in there in the mid to late 90s, and I actually just didn't paint or draw anything for a couple of years, which is not a great way to make a living if you're an artist.
Yeah.
But I did, just to pass on a little bit of thinking about what you put into your mind and how it can affect you. My friend Morgan Weisling had turned me on to Richard Schmid, who was
historic painter. Sure, of course.
You know,
well, everyone knows Morgan Weisling. Well, not everyone. Everyone in the art world. Morgan Weisling is one of the premier oil painters almost illustration within his oil paintings. There are stories.
Yeah,
they're
he'll
figurative.
Be offended that you said that, but yes.
Almost illustration. Are they? Hey.
And he was a very famous illustrator.
Yes, listen to this, but are they almost illustration or are they not?
Morgan's a very good friend of mine. I think they're wonderful paintings on their own. They stand alone.
They stand alone, but they are
storytelling.
Usually a storytelling of
they
an
are
oil
storytelling.
Painting.
So, yes, I have to agree with you. And if Morgan doesn't like it, sorry, Morgan. I agree with
Morgan
Tom.
Weisling.
Yes, you can take us both.
I don't sweat more. Oh, I'm a painter of the. Oh, I'm upset that Tom called it almost illustration. But isn't it funny, David Darrow at DarrowArt.com, that painters are snobs about illustrators, and illustrators, in a sense, are saying, "Oh, you hoity-toity painters, you don't know what it's like to make a living." And make a real living, and not just whatever, not just paint and live on daddy's dime or however you're living, or with your spouse or whomever, or with your trust fund or however you're doing it to make these giant paintings that no one buys, and we know that no one buys them.
Now you're asking a question that's kind of putting words in my mouth. Am I supposed to agree at the end of this?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, of course. But there is a divide, which is why so many. Art critics and artists have always had this incredibly tough time with Norman Rockwell.
Yeah, they call it. They say he wasn't.
It's not a painter.
I that happened to me in high school. I was already pretty well versed in Norman Rockwell because my mom brought me up to. She showed me. We had Norman Rockwell puzzles, and we had books around the house, and wall hangings and not wall hangings. I don't even know what that means.
Hanging from a wall.
And so in high school, I took a class called Great Issues with a teacher whose name I can't remember, and it's appropriate that I can't because I would mention it now. And he asked us we had to pick a figure who impacted society and describe them. So I picked Norman Rockwell as my favorite artist. And he corrected me in front of the whole class. Norman Rockwell was not an artist. He was an illustrator. And that day, I shut him off.
Right.
I didn't listen to anything he said the rest of it because I thought, what a stupid distinction.
Right.
Now, today, I think exactly the same thing. What a stupid distinction.
Of course.
Because people think illustrators, I don't know what they think about illustrators, and I don't know what they think about artists, but that argument goes on. It's
but
crazy.
The fact is, I guess my point is, Dave, that as I'm only kind of tangentially related to the art world with my paintings and my work in art. But the amazing thing to me is how human beings will make a caste system,
right,
no matter how they group together. And artists are just – I'm forever entertained by the way they will – put themselves on some artistic pedestal and have some lower position for someone who does something different from what they do.
Right.
You know, because you're at an art show.
Like, I think I'm better than a cross-stitcher.
Exactly.
But there's probably some fine cross-stitchers out there that could kick
who
my
are
tail.
Right now saying, try it,
yeah,
Darryl.
Just try it, Mr. Darryl.
But the fact is, as you know, the guys who throw big bags of paint at the wall and everything wouldn't have anything to do with an illustrator who does a beautiful painting of people in some situation, or even those great early, I mean, N.C. Wyeth, or in fact the whole Wyeth family, or those kinds of paintings, which are amazing works of art.
Yeah, and you mentioned Wyeth. He was one of my favorites, even as a high schooler.
Well, there are paintings. I'm from Pennsylvania, and Chad's Ford is where the Wyeths are from. So you see a lot of Wyeth paintings, and you hear a lot of Wyeth folklore. But when you look at those paintings, after studying painting for a while and learning something about it, the paintings are absolutely incredible.
Yeah,
I mean, I saw a painting of his with it, and it's some kind of illustration for some story. But the man is a steel worker, and he's leaning over the sledgehammer. You know, the head of the sledgehammer is on the ground, and he's leaning with both arms on his sledgehammer, and you can see, like, the glow of the red molten steel is illuminating him from the ground up, and he's just
mesmerizing, like, isn't it?
Wow.
Yeah,
it's
that must
just
be N.C. Wyeth,
it's just
the granddad.
Amazing. Just amazing. And and on by its own rights, a very beautiful painting.
Yeah. I don't know what the distinction is, but if somebody could tell me, I'd probably disagree with them. Yeah, there's probably a million or 100 art galleries in Beverly Hills that look down their noses at anything related to illustration or even realistic art. I don't know if that's changing. I hear that there's a renewal in realistic art, and it might just be the people participating in creating a website that says there's a...
Well, I suppose they're just like everything, just like music or movies or everything. Artists are sort of out there creating their own niches.
Yeah.
Or going after their own their own audiences. Jeremy Lipking and those... the guys doing this very, very, very realistic
beautiful
painting.
Stuff, yeah.
Beautiful paintings.
Lipking is great. Aaron Westerberg.
Mm-hmm.
Joseph Todorovich. Mm-hmm. There's a group of young guys. They're kind of like the, I think of them as the Brat Pack. Rat Pack. Sorry, not Brat Pack. That's different, isn't
it? The Brat Pack would they be singing in Las Vegas? No, the Brat Pack is from that movie, from the Breakfast Club or whatever.
there we go. So, yeah, I mix my packs. Mm-hmm. The Rat Pack, you know, the five guys that did Vegas. There's a group of young artists that are a big deal. They're very good artists, and they have personalities and style, and you always, they're associated with each other, works real well for them.
Mm-hmm.
And they're very good.
Do you
but painters and illustrators, I've never heard of a painter that wants to do well enough at painting to become an illustrator, but I have heard many illustrators, especially colleagues, people my age and in starting at the same time, that at some point halfway through their career say, I just want to get good enough at illustration, save enough money that I can become a painter.
And what does that mean? What would that mean to you? What does that mean?
For me,
I would like to become a painter.
This is what I project on them saying that. That for me, that means I would like to not have somebody tell me what I have to paint and then just try and work to their expectations. I would like to just paint what I want to paint and then have it
and then
sell.
Have someone appreciate it and then have an audience
not just
for
appreciate it. Buy it. You know, I want to make a living that way.
Right.
It's the artistic equivalent of, I would like to work and not have a boss, and I just want to be paid for because I'm really good at what I do.
Has the world of illustrators been changed by the advent of, say, Photoshop, computers, digital photography, all those kinds of things?
Absolutely. I saw my first art on a computer in the late 80s, and I thought, nothing to worry about. because you could see the pixels, and I thought, you know, that'll be a style of art. But I didn't think, I really didn't think that computers would get good enough. I had no imagination on computers. And then in 1990, a friend of mine scanned, just to show me how a scanner worked, scanned a photo from my wallet. And he didn't have enough money to buy a big system. He spent $5,000 on a Macintosh system and a scanner that only scanned in black and white. And I looked at my picture coming across his screen, filling his screen with this perfect photo. And then he showed me what he could do with a... Before Photoshop, there was a program called Digital Darkroom. And it does the same thing that Photoshop did. And Photoshop may have turned into... I mean, Digital Darkroom may have turned into Photoshop, or they bought them or something. I don't know. But when he showed me what he could do, I thought, well, that changes everything. These computers are good. And 5 years later, I wasn't getting any work. Everything was being done by the art directors.
The art directors themselves wouldn't have to hire anyone.
They didn't have to hire anyone. Yeah.
Because they could just get a picture of a car and put it over here and Photoshop it, and I need a sunset,
yeah,
and I need some dust in the background.
They didn't have to have a budget for an illustrator. Mm-hmm. Illustrators, I got so much work in the early 90s. I made more money than I've ever made in my entire life in 91, 92, and 93. Each year was my best year ever, by far, compared to now. Mm-hmm. And it was, most of that work was doing comps for the movie industry. And that was, a comp is short for comprehensive illustration, and it's just to show the idea to a client. And there really are people in very high places that command high incomes that cannot picture a thing in their mind. They have to see it.
And so for the new Iron Man 3, they will do the art for the poster and show, what, 6 posters, 10 posters? These are...
Oh, maybe hundreds.
Yeah, maybe just... This is all the kinds of looks that we might have around the marketing of this movie.
They just think of them as directions. Okay, here's another direction.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Here's another...
Yeah.
It's, you know, here's a different mood. Sometimes they want to promote it as a love story. Sometimes they want to promote it as an action film. It might be the same film. So I did a whole bunch of those. And it was really fast work, which really worked well with my ADD head, because I could get into something and focus on it for 5 or 6 hours and get it done. And it would pay pretty well. I could get, sometimes I could do 2 of these overnight and get $900 a piece for them, which was pretty good money in the 90s. It's really good money now.
Yeah.
And so I got, you know, I did the stupid thing we always do when we're making really good money. You up your lifestyle into an area that you can't afford if the money disappears. And so I kind of got myself in trouble that way.
Uh-huh.
But it was really good money doing these comps, things that the public would never see. They would be stacked up on a wall in a boardroom somewhere. I never went to one of the meetings. And they would bring the VP of marketing in and the heads of the guys that were funding the movie, all the people making financial decisions, and they would sit around and make the decision based on my art and someone else putting the type on it with rub-down type. And they'd wipe them all out and say, let's see 10 more. And so they'd hire illustrators to do those. So there was a lot of work for illustrators that could draw really well. And it was really a lot of work for people who drew people that were instantly recognizable.
Mm-hmm.
And this is just, if you know the time frame of when Terminator 2 came out, that was when I was getting my most work. And I did a whole bunch of sketches, you know, very finished-looking sketches of Terminator. And I was pretty proud of those. Mm. But I was proud of what I was working on. And, you know, it was big-name stuff.
Yeah.
And there was this one film I got involved. It was actually the first one I ever did for Universal. I got called in by Tom Martin, who was the VP of marketing at Universal. And he asked me, can you draw like Drew Struzan? You know who that is?
I know the name.
Mm-hmm. Okay, he did all the Back to the Future posters and Indy Jones and all that. So I said humbly, no, but I can try and fake it. And he had seen stuff in my portfolio that was really a direct knockoff of Drew Struzan. And
I probably met Drew because I was always going into the art. Back to the Future, I was always going to the art director offices just to look at guys draw stuff and make stuff because it was cool.
Yeah.
So I'm sure we met.
And I said, I think I can. And so he had some ideas. You're going to love this story. He had some ideas he wanted me to work on, but he needed to make a phone call. So I sat down in the couch outside his lobby, and you walked by. I still remember
that. Oh, boy, this is doing great.
I swear it's true. And I just said, I recognized you from something you were in at the time. I don't remember what it was. And I I said, hi. I think I said something like, I enjoy your work.
What did I say? Was I a gentleman?
You were very friendly. You were very nice, yeah. And I thought, I'm not saying this just because you're sitting right here. I've actually told people this before I ever met you again, that I said, yeah, I couldn't remember your name.
Yeah.
I didn't even know your name.
That's all right.
I met Biff. That's what I said. I said the B word. I'm sorry.
Yeah, you could have looked it up, though.
The internet existed then.
You could have.
No, I was like on AOL. It was like 5 hours for $75 a month.
I was nice to you, though.
You were very nice to me.
Could have looked up.
You said
my name.
Hi. You smiled. You looked me in the eye. And you said,
So I'm right. I did hang out in the art.
Yes, you are. Yes.
I still have a few drawings of theirs that they just that they set aside, or they made up for me and stuff.
They stole them.
I have
some pieces at home that I was going to throw away that have drawings I did of you.
Deserve to have that.
Yes, you do. I think you should have them for free.
I think I should have them for free. I especially don't think I should pay you for them.
Exactly, because I was just an illustrator.
Because you were just an illustrator. You weren't a painter or anything.
No, I wasn't.
Not like a real artist.
No. So I became a painter because I wasn't an illustrator anymore, and I did not decide not to be an illustrator. I became
just
not an illustrator.
Up.
Yeah.
What kind of work are you doing mostly now? Portraits.
I have managed to build a reputation as a good portrait artist, and the compliments I get the most are that you seem to really cap. I don't even know this person, and I can tell what they're like. So I capture some essence of these people, and I feel good that people compliment me in that way.
And are these commissioned from the internet, or
yeah,
what?
They're finding me on the internet. Uh-huh. I still have not found anybody that can tell me exactly how they found me.
Yeah.
But I think people are finding me by looking up the obvious words, portrait painter, oil painter, people, that kind of thing. And then they notice my work, so they bookmark me, and then they go look at other artists. And then the ones that come back to me, I ask them, how'd you find me? I'm not really sure.
And how can people reach you? DarrowArt.com.
Yeah.
And you have a blog on there?
Yes, but I'm revamping it. It's going to be less about me and my personal thoughts
and more a business kind of thing?
No, I was going to be more your thoughts.
As well it should be.
About you.
So they can find you at Darrow Art anywhere else?
DarrowArt.com.
Oh, wait a minute. You do a show on Ustream.
I do a broadcast, not a show. I call it a paint cast because it's got a hipper name.
Then a show?
Paint cast?
Okay.
I mean, you get right away what it's about,
right? That's true, I guess, yeah.
Unless you don't know what cast means.
But while you're live painting your subjects and everything, you are actually on Ustream doing it live.
Yeah.
There's a chat going on. You're talking about the process of the painting.
Yeah.
And where can people find that?
That's at Dave. This sounds silly, but I just became this accidentally. DaveThePaintingGuy.com.
DaveThePaintingGuy.com.
Yeah, and Painting Guy has two G's in the middle. Got to remember that.
Painting
Guy. You have to
guy,
end one word.
Not the painting guy.
Right, exactly. Because if I said it that way, people would go to the wrong place. So if you sing, you act, you do voiceovers. I consider acting and voiceover different.
Okay.
Different skills, although closely related. And you paint.
Yes.
If you had to pick one, or if one of them just turned out to make you a whole lot of money and you could live comfortably for the rest of your life doing just one of those, what would you pick?
I would paint.
You would paint, really? It's that dear to your heart, or it's just something you can do with less headaches than the rest? Or how would you?
There's something about a day of painting that both it takes you out of yourself because it's both very concentrated and yet concentrated in a beautiful way because you're working with color, you're working with shape. It's both utterly simple and incredibly complex, which in my opinion takes you far out of yourself as you're in a very concentrated, almost meditative-like state, which I find that...
I agree.
And enchanting, and there is something, and I'm not saying that I haven't done very satisfying things as an actor or as a singer, as a musician or whatever, but those things are very immediate, and then they're gone to me.
You don't get to look back.
And at the end of a day, and most days, I freely admit, at the end of a day of painting, I will put down the brush and honestly and say, well, I wrecked it. You know, most days. However, there are some days.
Do you find that you wreck it by just doing something bad, or is it because you overwork it? I mean, that's a term.
Overwork it, yes. Overwork it. And both, doing something bad, and it just doesn't look in the way I would imagine it to look. Well, and it looks horrible, I wrecked it. Okay, I'll let it dry or scrape it off and redo it.
Do you start over?
I'm the king of scraping.
Oh, man.
People in my classes, when I was taking a lot of art classes, and everyone's painting a still life, and it's a few oranges, and an apple there, and a flower, and whatever. And at the end of about every class, I would draw a pretty good painting of oranges and an apple. At the end of the class, everyone's saving it. They're taking it off the easel. They're putting it in a bag so it doesn't get smudged to show people. And I'm taking out a painting knife and just going down the painting. And they're all going, "What a goal! What are you doing?" I said, I really don't need a collection of 80, like, sort of okay paintings of oranges.
What I don't have is canvas.
Exactly. What I don't, canvas is not cheap. So I just scrape it off and start again.
I saw people doing that in art school all the time. I don't mean a bunch of people. There would be somebody in the class that would scrape everything off or get out the turpentine and a rag and just wash it down.
Mm-hmm.
And I just figured that was always a high-level frustration. And I'll never be an artist if I keep painting like this. So I always interpreted it as...
Well, there's
failure in front of their friends. Which
I think there's a lot of that too. Okay. There's a lot of that too.
Was that?
Did you want to get
rid of it before anybody really saw it?
No. When I started to take it seriously, when I really started to study and not quit, and saying I'm here for the duration. I'm going to stay, which was interesting because most people and boy, I should have let you go a long time ago, and I'm sorry about that. Most people in painting classes, because I think the learning curve is so steep at the very beginning. It's so very steep that I've been in so many classes, Dave, where people burst into tears.
I've seen that.
Where they throw brushes across the room.
I've seen that.
I've seen a guy pick up his easel in a landscape painting, pick up his easel, the painting, all of his paints, and literally throw it off a cliff. Screaming. The frustration is so high because you have a thing in your mind and you see the other people's paintings and you don't want to make a copy of theirs, but you want something that's satisfying to say, this came out of my heart. And I think, and when it really looks bad, that's hard. So I think the thing that helped me was admitting to myself that I'm absolutely terrible, that I am the worst one. I'll stand in the back. I will stink. I freely admit it. Everyone is better than me, except I'm not quitting. I'll be back next week. I will scrape it down, and I will come back. The interesting thing with that is the teachers respected that and started helping me extra.
Yep, yep.
I became really kind of the teacher's pet, even with those imperious, when I've taken a lot of painting classes
imperious,
now.
Imperious, what does that mean?
The imperious, the grander, looking down my nose at everyone, and I will tell you how to paint this bowl. And it's very intimidating to everyone. But even those people, I think in their mind, would say, we have a guy who's not going to quit.
Yeah,
he's not crying or throwing brushes.
He really wants to learn this.
So then, honestly, then they come around behind you and say, well, listen, when we're drawing a figure in the painting, this is how we begin to think about what a person would look like in this painting.
Yeah.
With what their position is, with how their arm rests on the table, with all those kinds of things that most of the people don't get that lesson because they're so frustrated. They're just going, oh, God, I suck. So you can't get through to that.
Yeah.
So I think that helped me a lot. And just the humor of it, just me having a good sense of humor about when, because as you said, in an art class, at the end of the class, I mean, everyone takes their piece and they're leaning it up against the wall. And it would be, great painting, good painting, amazingly great painting, good painting, good painting, Tom's good painting. You know, and I'm freely like, look, my yes, mine is definitely the worst, except I'm not a quitter.
Yeah.
And the amazing thing, look, many things happen in our lives, in our careers, and but one of those touchstone moments for me in working through my art and doing that stuff was the time, the first time, a different student in the class came up to me with a painting and said, you know, what? I think my composition is off on this thing because the tree is over here. And I thought,
you're asking me?
Why are you asking me? Was, oh, she told me to come and ask you.
Oh.
Yeah, the teacher said, yeah, go ask him because his composition is strong now, so he'll be able to say something because I'm busy.
Oh, that's nice.
So you just think, wow, through this thick skull, like something
in.
Got through.
That's nice.
And, you know, those are the little tiny moments that we remember.
And that was very wise of the teacher to do that. It not only encouraged you, but it got a second opinion to this other student.
Right, right.
Here's someone that understands what I've been teaching them. Talk to him, and you don't have to just hear it from me.
Right,
that's,
right.
That's great. What a great moment for you.
It was very nice. It was very nice. But I have to, I really have to keep it up. It's like speaking Spanish or something. It's not, painting is not riding a bike to me. I can, it's like going to the gym.
All right, so here's the question you don't want to be asked.
Yeah.
How often do you paint?
I paint now,
yeah,
not nearly as often as I would like to right now.
Is something getting in the way besides just not wanting to pick up the brushes?
Well, yeah, just making, you know, making a living and paying for a lot of school tuitions and stuff. Yeah. That kind of stuff, and traveling, a lot of travel,
yeah,
and those sorts of things. So I've even tried, you know, I tried to took those water mixable oils on the road, and it just doesn't work out. I need, yeah, you know, you need your brain, you need to get into it a little bit. You need a little bit of time to calm down and get into your zone of painting.
Yeah, so, I think people should see your work. And do you still have the site up?
Oh, sure, bigpopfun.com.
Yeah. I think you do very good work.
Thank you, Dave.
Very good work.
That means the world to me.
And do you have a mailing list of people that want to see, like, when you do a show, a future show? Do you have a way of notifying those people?
I don't think I do. I don't do that really.
Get one. You should do that.
Yeah, I'll do that.
Like, do you like showing up at your gallery shows?
I love it.
Do you like being there?
I love it. Yeah,
okay.
It's just like putting on a show. It's just like putting on a play or writing a song or something. It's just that's where you say, hey, these are some things that I did. It just came out of my head and my brush, and I hope you like them.
Yeah.
And when people actually like them, it means a lot. It feels great. I mean, you know, it's not for everybody.
No, and it's for, unfortunately, it's for some people that have some money.
Yeah, I hope.
And I got to thank you, by the way, for promoting the arts the way you do. I think that's been a really big thing. I've actually quoted you on my Facebook page and seen people repost it. You know, if you want to support the arts, buy art. And then a long string of, here's something you can do, you know, to go to a live show and buy a little painting. I think that's a great thing you've been doing.
Well, thanks, Dave.
Very inspiring to me, and I'm just trying to show gratitude for that.
Well, thank you. That means a lot to me, too, because I think it's true. I think the first thing that artists should do is start supporting other artists and just start giving the arts the dignity that they deserve, that a lot of people are out there working very hard on things that are interesting and beautiful and worth people's attention.
Yeah.
Over, not necessarily over their smartphone, but let's face it, in addition to their smartphone, it can really enrich your life to have something that's actually made by a person or performed by a person to give them your attention and to try to understand where they're coming from and what they're doing. It's, you know, it's meant a lot to me. So I think everyone has to go out there and don't just complain about the arts and say, you know, it's all over and all these kids with the screens and everything. Well, just go to a show. Go do something.
Take your kids to an art show.
Take your kids to an art show and show them this is a painting. The artist, look at the impasto. Look at how we can see the brush, as I did to my kids at the Getty Center. And you could see Vincent van Gogh's work. And you say, look at this. Look at this part. Look at that flower. And look at the brushwork in that. Look at the color that he put on there. And it's the it's exactly the same as when he put that brushstroke, bang, onto that tulip.
Yeah, that day he did that, and we're looking at it now.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's awesome.
It's just wonderful.
How many things can we do? How many things can anyone do that'll still be around 500, 600 years later?
Right, exactly.
Or even 10 years later.
Yep. Or those the wonderful magic of a John Singer Sargent portrait. You know, they're in the Met or the National Gallery. There are these portraits, and these. I mean, he was so great at. But there's a woman holding a fan,
yeah.
And as you get closer and closer to the painting, you just say, "Oh my gosh, it's like, you know, 12 brushstrokes."
Yeah.
But the color is so perfect that he yeah. just went bang, 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 bang. A little white highlight. Fan. Total fan from 10 feet away. I mean, it's unbelievable.
You couldn't have painted a better fan.
Exactly.
And you did it so simply. Amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's great. I hope that people contact you on DaveThePaintingGuy.com, DarrowArt.com. I hope that those older, very rich Southern families hire you to make 8-foot by 6-foot paintings of all of their ancestors.
Good, yeah, and I'll even do a fire truck if somebody really wants one.
Wow, really?
I heard it sells.
Cool.
So,
thanks, buddy.
Thank you.
Well, Dave's a very interesting guy who's actually made a living as a visual artist, an illustrator, and a painter his entire adult life, which is, yeah, if you think that's easy, give it a try. But thanks so much for listening. Thanks to Emily Wilson for producing. Thanks to Chris, Katie, everybody in Nerdist Industries. Thanks to McPherson Guitars for helping me out with the live show. I'm coming to Orlando, as well as many other cities. I'll try to tell you about them. But thanks so much for listening. Tell a friend, consider subscribing to the podcast, and we'll talk to you next time. Bye.
Now leaving Nerdist.com.